George Kimble, Kerry Haskell here, and Bruce Pratt joining us for this week's edition of Sports Lit 101. Welcome back, Bruce.
Well, good to be back. Can't wait till I can actually be there, but we're all going to be smart about that. Yeah, one of the things I really wanted to look into this year was to look back at some books that I read or knew about when I was younger. And in light of the current scholarship and the current books, see if they held up, if what I'd learned from those books was still really valid. And I remember reading Invisible Men, though I did not read it all. I had a chance to look at it back in the mid-80s. I was waiting for my son at a story hour or something at a library. And I remember thinking, well, you should finish reading that book. When I saw that it had been re-released with an updated introduction by Don Rogerson, the author, I thought I'd read it. It's from Nebraska, and I read it. And I was glad I did, because we've had the book about Oscar Charleston. We talked about The Pitcher and the Dictator, about Satchel Paige and Trujillo. And so in the last 4 or 5 years, we've looked at times at the Negro Leagues. But what I think a lot of us forget is that the Negro Leagues disappeared not out of generosity of white people. It did not disappear because people suddenly had an awakening. It's because Branch Rickey and others figured they could make money. He understood that the New York Yankees and other teams that were either co-owners, at least their stadiums, to Negro League teams, were making much more money than he was. And Jackie Robinson was a courageous man. I wouldn't ever say anything bad about Jackie Robinson, but he probably wasn't the 25th best Negro League player of that time. So when you look back at the history of the Negro Leagues, what's really important to remember is that when it began in 1920, Rube Foster, who started the league, wanted to make baseball players who are African American and wanted to give them a chance to be seen so that the major leagues would want them. His idea was not to always have a Negro League, but it was a way of, in his mind, of starting the process of integration. However, the Negro Leagues became very profitable for certain people, come Posey, Greenlee, all these guys that got involved in it. Clark Griffith, who was part owner of the Homestead Grays, who were outdrawing his Washington Senators by 5,000 a game. But what really changed the climate was Latin baseball. And we saw a little bit of that in The Pitcher and the Dictator, and we've seen it in the Oscar Charleston book too. But what would happen is Tris Speaker, Ty Cobb, Sal Magley, I'm just throwing some names out, different times, went down to play in the winter leagues in the Caribbean. And they played alongside black ball players. And one of the people who went down and played there was Tommy Lasorda, who said that he saw the best hitters he'd ever seen were there, and they were Negro League players. So we can look at the history of the Negro Leagues a couple of ways, and I like to look at it as really one of the most incredible self-inventions. I mean, baseball was, as we all know, in the 1940s in America and the 1920s, 30s, actually from the late 1800s on, was the game. It was the game in Latin America, too. And as soon as it was exported to Asia, it was the game there. People revered baseball. They looked on other sports as interesting. Boxing, yeah, football a little bit. But baseball was the big deal. And yet, many of the best players weren't allowed to play in the major leagues. Now that they're looking at the records of the Negro Leagues and they're going to elevate them to the status of Major League Baseball, we come to that famous, well, they weren't playing against the major leagues. Yeah, but you know what? The major leagues weren't facing Smokey Joe. They weren't facing Satchel Paige. They weren't trying to get Cool Papa Bell out. They weren't pitching to Josh Gibson. And they didn't exist in a bubble. The white guys played against them all the time. Bob Feller was constantly saying, you know, why aren't you bringing these guys in? I can't get them out. And so what's really good about this is the guy who wrote this and who's also produced the public television documentary, There Was Always Sun Shining Someplace, is a PhD in American Studies. So he puts this in the kind of historical context, and it reads more like a novel than it does. It's in no way is this what I call a college professor book. It's just chock full of anecdotes and stories. There are a couple of things in there where he repeats some stories about Ty Cobb, which we may have learned from later sources are not exactly true. But most of all the stuff that he talks about of importance, he has the words of the former players. Remembering that in 1983, a lot of those guys were still alive. In fact, there wasn't officially a National Negro League into the 60s. We sort of think that with Robinson getting in, that was over. It's also a very sordid tale of how once Jackie Robinson was in the league, people like Branch Rickey and others just stole players. They signed them. They didn't compensate Negro League teams the way they would have had to compensate other teams. Monty Irvin, who wrote one of the two introductions to the book, the original introduction, was purchased finally by the New York Giants for $5,000 in an era where a white player would have gone for $100,000. And he had to take a pay cut to go from the Negro Leagues to the big leagues, something it turned out for him in the end. But it's really it's a fascinating story. And what I really like about it is it shows us just how far back people understood how important this was and how long it's taken for baseball to do something about this. I mean, I don't think the American public, for the most part, wouldn't have agreed that a lot of these guys belonged in the Hall of Fame, but they didn't even consider Josh Gibson and Satchel Paige until Ted Williams was enshrined. And he said, I hope someday those two guys get enshrined because they deserve it. Also, I want to point out that one of the big fans of this book is Ken Burns, who wrote that it's a fascinating book and a milestone in baseball scholarship. So he read this after it came out and before he did his wonderful documentary series for PBS on baseball. And there are a lot of other people that have spoken very highly of this book. I think that that any reader, anybody who likes sports at all, will be fascinated by this and by all the ins and outs and the ways that people had to struggle to survive, but also by the wonderful, in the middle of the book, there's just some great pictures, lots of wonderful pictures of some of these old guys that played well before there was television and well before anybody could have seen them play again on film. But it's really, really a fine book. Invisible Men, Life in Baseball's Negro Leagues, with a foreword by Monty Irvin and a new introduction by the author. And it is from Nebraska Press.
Excellent. I look forward to catching up with that one. Bruce, very good to talk with you as always. And we've got much more coming up. You'll be with us next week for our final Sports Lit 101 of 2020.
Yes, and I'm not sure which book. We've got three great books came in. Travis Bogan has a new book on boxing films. We have, and I think it's pronounced Zito. I'm trying to get a name. Courtney Zito has written a book called Changing on the Fly, which is about the popularity of hockey in Canada among people from South Asia and No Game for Boys to Play. Kathleen Bashinsky's controversial and so far a little bit I've read very interesting book on the dangers of youth football. So we got a lot of good stuff.
And you sent me the link. I haven't had a chance to watch it yet, but I'm hoping to get to it here over the holiday weekend. Looking forward to seeing the documentary. We've talked about the book, Res Metal.
Yeah, let me tell you, that is one fabulous documentary. I think it runs about an hour and a half, something like that. The man who made it is an Iranian by birth, and he has in the movie what Michael Powell did in Canyon Dreams. No intrusion by the filmmaker. It's all about the people involved talking about themselves and the heavy metal music and the culture. But it's astonishingly, surprisingly interesting. I was just riveted to it. And as I pointed out, I'm not a metal fan. But it's really a terrific movie.
Excellent. Well, I'm looking forward to checking that out. We talk about it perhaps next week as well. Bruce with Sports Lit 101 every Wednesday here on Downtown.